Dr. Yuri Maltsev received his MA in History and Social Sciences at Moscow State University and his PhD in Economics at the Institute for Labor Research in Moscow. Dr. Maltsev has authored 5 monographs, contributions to 16 books, and 73 articles in American, Russian, Turkish, Japanese, and Taiwanese journals, magazines, and newspapers. He is currently a professor of economics at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Today he will lecture on Capitalism, Cuba, and Castro, a report from recent travels. Dr. Maltsev.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Really, my kind of bizarre background, being a defector from the Soviet Union, I was all the time thinking when I will have a nostalgia about the Soviet Union, about socialism, but not. And maybe what 4 or 5 years ago, I decided to go to Cuba to have a look what's going on there to satisfy my need to be back into the time when I was a young person. And sure enough, all my expectations were absolutely fulfilled. Because a good old friend stopped by and said, probably it'll be a funny presentation. It would be funny if it wouldn't be so gruesome what's going on in Cuba today. It's really a disaster of immense proportions. I'm so sorry for Cuban people who are experiencing way more in their 50 years of their revolution. They got the full dose of it. I mean, they got as much probably as Soviets did in their 80 years of their disaster. The socialist deconstructionist, Mr. Castro, he said, "I'm a dreamer who has seen some of his dreams become reality." And if you will go and have a look at the Cuba right now, then you would think that this kind of dreams can come only to a completely schizophrenic mind. The travel, because it looks like it should be a travel story more than an academic report, and rightly so. There's not much of academic study to be done about Cuban economy, because if we would apply a vision of Mises and his characteristic of socialism, it's not an economy at all. It's not an economy at all. It's not. If we would say that Soviet economy, say, or economy of other socialist countries, was just a simple system of management, then if we would apply that to Cuban economy, it's not even simple of management. It's just some kind of a devious plot to destroy everything. It doesn't manage anything. So Cuban economy, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, Cuban economy went into a free fall. And from 1990 to 1994, the foreign payments received by Cuba plummeted by 85%. Why I'm saying that? What's very important about foreign payments receipts? There are plenty of books produced by the U.S. academia and by a very numerous cohort of Cuban lovers in the United States. Some of them, they published by, say, Princeton University Press or Columbia University Press. These are monographs pretending to provide us with some scientific wisdom on, for example, exchanges between Cuban economy and Soviet economy. That some of them would research why would Soviets, for example, buy Cuban sugar 7 times the price of the world market. They would pay 7 times more than the world market for sugar, that the world price for sugar would be. And why would they sell oil to Cuba for the price about 2 times lower than the world market price for oil at that very time? And they would come up with a lot of interesting ideas, and they would kind of try to figure out that maybe there's something wrong with the economic mentality and whatnot, without realizing that was not trade. That was not trade at all. That was a direct payment for the blood of Cuban soldiers who would be killed in the battlefields of Angola or Syria or or for the blood of Cuban so-called instructors who would train terrorists in Guatemala or Colombia or Peru or Bolivia. It was nothing to do with economy, and even for the Soviet leaders at that time, leaders like Mr. Khrushchev, who organized, you remember, the first Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, together with President Kennedy, definitely they did it in tandem. But for him to say this is just a payment for each Cuban terrorist killed, or for each academic mind from the United States captured by Fidel, then that would sound kind of a little bit cynical. So because of that, the Soviets designed in the beginning of 1960s this very devious but primitive scheme of how to pump the liquidity into Cuban economy, which otherwise would not survive. And today is a good example that without this liquidity, Cuban economy is not surviving at all. So I mentioned that I had this desire to have a look at this last relic of socialism, maybe short of North Korea, on this planet, and to take my students to inoculate them against this deadly disease, which really is like AIDS, I think, like mental AIDS. So we went to. Then I realized that to do that, you need to comply with the Helms-Burton Act, which promises 10 years of jail and $10,000 fine or both for going to Cuba. You know that embargo is still in place, which is, I would say, the most funny kind of travesty. It came straight, I think, out of Graham Greene's book, Our Man in Havana, because embargo is it's something like Soviet taxation, when the taxes would be very high, but on the good side, nobody would pay it. Yeah. So the embargo is a thing like that. I went through this paperwork of getting a license. You need a government license. So I have kind of profiteering from the little government monopoly I have. It's a five-year-long license to go to Cuba. And as President Bush last year, he made a speech about travel to Cuba. I was so surprised. About 15 minutes, he was talking one of these press conferences that some people would use this travel instead of studying communism and socialism seriously in Cuba. They would spend time on the beach and they would scuba dive and swim and snorkel. And I thought that sounds like a good plan. Sure, that it's not my first trip. I've been in Cuba two times before, and all the time I see this, it kind of all the time reminds me of the phrase of Ludwig von Mises, that we are all historians of decline. Well, if you would like to see decline in accelerated pace, I mean, we are in decline here, but the decline with a capital D, then Cuba is a good place, as you'll get a bargain of decline for your buck for watching decline. Decline in Cuban economy, it wasn't many Cuban lovers or Fidelites in our academia, they would think that Cuban collapse was as artificial kind of because the Soviet Union pulled out, that Cuba otherwise would be viable and its economy, the idea is that its economy in 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s were doing very well, and only because the Soviet Union collapsed, because socialism is no more in the Soviet Union. So that inflicted great problems for Cuban people as well as for people in the United States. This is not true at all. Cuban economy was in a free fall in 1980s. It was not doing well in 1960s and 1970s. If you would recollect who was the first minister of economics of Cuba, you would shiver. That was Che Guevara. Che Guevara was not just a terrorist in straight form. He was not just murdering people through through shooting them from his rifle. He did that a lot in his life, but he was also murdering people through central planning, of which he was a grandmaster in the beginning of 1960s. Fidel Castro and Che Guevara, they belong, both of them, and Raul as well, they belong to another branch of communists, which we don't hear much. And they were kind of closet Trotskyites. Why closet? Because Trotsky was condemned by the Soviet elite. And so that's why Fidel would not admit, and Che Guevara would not admit, that they're Trotskyites. However, right now they do admit, because the masters in Kremlin are gone. And today Fidel openly said that that he likes what Leo Trotsky, that it's a romantic version of communism, of which he and his great friend Che Guevara, before his death, and he was implementing until 1967, his death, the Trotskyite version of Marxism. What is the difference between Trotskyism and Leninism? Because still Trotsky, there are plenty of Trotskyists, more Trotskyists right now, I think, in U.S. Marxist movement. In the U.S. Marxist movement, we have Trotsky still extremely popular, as well as Che Guevara. These people, they believe that that you can only have the world communist revolution, world communist. You cannot build socialism. You cannot have socialist country by itself. If the socialism won in one single country, then this country should be performing a role of the something called small motor, small engine, and then it should jumpstart the big engine, the world, through the transmission belt, which would be professional revolutionaries like Che Guevara, like Fidel, like other people who would consider, say, Cuba or Soviet Union just as a kind of as a starter for the communist revolution, So from this perspective, and Che wrote and spoke a lot about it, I visited his museum in Santa Clara, and definitely all the stuff is right there. So his point is that Cuban people can probably endure a lot of hardships and a lot of losses, knowing about their historic mission to liberate the whole continent of Latin America, because that was division of labor between Soviets and Cubans. Cubans were in charge of Latin America. So his point was that we should endure a lot. We should suffer maybe for a while, but then we'll have this glorious future. The whole continent will be liberated, and the soft underbelly of the United States would be hit by this Cuban developments, how to implement it? You need to militarize everything. Leo Trotsky was saying that the only way to do it is because Leo Trotsky was quite a bright but evil individual. He would write poetry in French, and he was also an artist and. Not so. He wasn't stupid, at least like his followers in U.S. academia. His point was he realized that the only way to make socialism work is to shoot people and to militarize economy. So his point was that every enterprise is a battalion, every agricultural farm is a company in the great army of socialist change, in the great army of socialist change. These are the ideas which Cubans, especially people like Fidel and Che Guevara, Cien Fuegos, or other, many of them, would profess in 1960s, 1970s. So the whole Cuba was mobilized to do exactly that. So what they did, they nationalized everything in 1959, 1960. That's a pretext for our embargo on Cuba, which is also, I would say, a travesty, not only because it's limiting our own rights. It doesn't limit Fidel Castro's rights on anything. It doesn't impact, I think, even Cuban, what's being, what's rest, left of the Cuban economy. It's just prohibiting your rights, your choices, whether you can go to Cuba or not. Otherwise, it's not. It's the most amazing thing is what our government is doing. That we have embargo from one hand, the people like ourselves can be jailed, can get a ticket for $10,000. From one hand. From another hand, United States government is providing something called humanitarian aid to Castro regime at the tune of $6 billion during the last 5 years. $6 billion, that's about twice higher than Cuban annual export revenue. So can you imagine that we're practically feeding this socialist parasite? And the only thing you can eat in Cuba right now is the Tyson chicken. Nothing else. I mean, there's no other sources of protein. Cuban government prohibited Cuban citizens to eat beef. Beef is considered to be bad for you. and so that's the combination of political and health arguments. So you can only... their choices... choices what the Cubans have are extremely... extremely... This is a Cuban store, peso store. So you can see that not much you can buy in a peso store. And then what is this? This white and red boxes. This is starch. So it's very difficult, I think, to feed your family or to satisfy your needs with starch. They, however, I would be definitely just engaged in anti-communist slander again if I wouldn't tell you the whole story that besides starch, which is not rationed, I mean, you can have as much starch as you wish. So everything else, however, is rationed. Not much else. You can see that this is the list of what is provided to you by Cuban government. Interestingly enough, you cannot take pictures in this kind of stores. But fortunately for me, I have a good friend who was trained in Soviet Union as a kind of was a wonderful group of people who were trained in Soviet Union, and so I can go to Cuba and speak Russian to them, and they would be like exactly like Russians, like really like black Russians. They would sit around and drink vodka until the crack of dawn, and speak Russian. And many of them do profess it without even visiting Russians, just by themselves. They have a Russian club and whatnot. So this is so he took these pictures from me, we just visited. You can see that a Cuban citizen living in Havana, in provinces that's an unattained ideal, can get four pounds of rice per month, 3 pounds of beans per month, 5 boxes of matches, one tube of dental paste, toothpaste, then 150 grams of coffee, that would be just one third of a pound of coffee, and one glass. I saw people receiving that glass of vegetable oil, which looked like a old motor oil here, because it was extremely unclear and smelled very badly. But that's about it. Leche, for example, which what is milk? Yeah, milk is only for children under seven, and for adults who are smart enough to be members of the Communist Party. So everybody else can only ask children. How this leche tastes like. So that's the Cuban. Not many people realize also what an immense humanitarian disaster this Cuba is. Because average wage in Cuba is $10 a month. It's 275 pesos a month. Right now, official exchange rate is 1 to 27. So $1 buys 27 pesos. However, on the streets, people would be happy to exchange 50 pesos for $1. That would reduce the their monthly wage to $5 already instead of $10, instead of $10. So they have the economy, or whatever it is, where people are surviving on $10 a month. I'm not saying, I will tell you a little bit later about haves also, that's not only have-nots, but also people who do have, who lead a privileged lifestyle in that society. But those people who do not have, say, dollar remittances from Miami, that people who are not members of the Communist Party elite, not members of propaganda, huge propaganda machine, but ordinary workers, peasants, doctors, even, they have the same salary. What's great about Cuba, that the wage differentials are really, I mean, they're following Leo Trotsky and Vladimir Lenin, both in spirit and literally, because wage differentials are like between 950 and 1050. So if you are a doctor, if you are, for example, a cardiologist or a surgeon or whatever, then maybe you will get 1050. And if you are a manual laborer in the fields, then you will get 950. So the wage differences are not very, very huge. Not very huge. What's interesting, that it's a great class you can have in Cuba. Why a great class? Because even the student, I mean, the least achiever, I would say, or person with learning disabilities, as they call right now. So the last person with learning disability, being in Cuba, would say, what kind of society is that? And they would say slavery, and that's it. Yeah, because it is slavery. It's a socialized slavery. Yes, and Hans Hoppe wrote about that. About private slavery and socialized government slavery, and that's exactly what all Cuba is. It's a government slavery. It's a collective ownership of slaves, collective ownership by a very small elite, and that's what do they have? Because if you I visited a couple of times agricultural enterprises in Cuba, and they would tell you a success story that, for example, when they were not as good as they are right now they're the first on the whole island, their salary was 220 pesos a month, so that would be about, what, $8 a month. And now it's already 290 pesos a month, so it's just already 1050. So if you will divide it by 30, that means people are working from anywhere from 32 to 45 cents a day. Then another thing which not many people do understand in the United States, especially not Cuban lovers, because the whole island is still infested for people who are looking for wisdom there, coming from places ranging from California, Montana, or Finland. Amazing that you cannot change jobs in Cuba. You cannot move around island in Cuba. That means that if you are getting your 32 cents a day, in maybe not in such advanced enterprise where you could get 45 cents a day, that you cannot change this enterprise, you cannot change your place of employment, because the chairwoman of the collective farm, which I'm thinking is just used for tourists because she spoke perfect English and whatnot, she said, well, you came from a communist country yourself, you should realize that if I would let my people go, then they would just increase an output quota for me, the plan target. Then they would say, well, if you have extra people that you don't need to in your enterprise, that you're letting them go, because she can actually not let them go, but she can sign a petition to some upper bureaucrat who would decide if this person can go, say, to Havana or to Santiago de Cuba and be reunited with his wife or other members of the family and whatnot. So she said that she cannot sign this kind of petition. She cannot side with people trying to leave this wonderful slave plantation she's running and move to some other slave plantation, just because then her superiors would say, well, you have too many people. That means that you should have your output quota should go up. Well, labor in Cuba, which I saw, was manual labor. The enterprises which were built by Soviets, numerous enterprises, right now are completely gone. I mean, there's nothing there. It's just empty walls, usually, or rusting equipment. No employment there at all, because there were no, there were artificial creations there. There was no need for them. There's no market for their goods. They were sending these goods from the other side of the world back to Soviet Union, just to keep some Cubans happy about that and show these enterprises as the great achievements of socialism on the American continent. So now they are all gone. All tractors, I've seen only tractors which in Havana are pulling this huge, they call it camel buses. Camel bus would be just a huge covered platform pulled by, I will show you the picture, pulled by a tractor, and that's the only means of public transportation which most people can enjoy. So this is the state of real estate here. I will return back to the previous one. Yeah, so this is a Havana was probably one of the most beautiful places on earth before this disaster descended on Havana. Now many areas, I'm not saying all areas, you will see some beautiful looking ones which are still being supported by tourist dollars. But many of them like that. That's the typical, the Chevy 1954 typical way of people going around. Interestingly enough, they have a lot of Soviet cars, but which are way younger than what they had. And most Soviet cars are already over the road. So it looks like socialist cars, unlike what Khrushchev was saying, are much worse than capitalist cars. And he was saying our socialist bulls and cars and planes are much better than capitalist cars. So he was, looks like, lying again. Yeah, this is cooperative. It's cooperative because cooperative, that means co-owned by somebody. I don't know, maybe it's co-owned by Fidel and Raul, because these people definitely don't have any stake in anything. And for them to keep themselves busy, and that probably you can get another peso or two if you will do this this wonderful visual propaganda displays on your workplace. All these plants are being planted and harvested manually. To please Cuban lovers in the United States, they call it organic agriculture. Because it's really organic because they don't have any fertilizers or pesticides or anything else. So it's here it's like various slogans condemning U.S. imperialism and the gross human rights abuses in the United States and things like that. Yeah, this is this travel thing. And it's pulled by this. Usually it's at night, so it's not crowded. But I was thinking that they probably can fit 1,000 of people in one of this. So it's... Yeah, this line is, sure enough, it's not for rice, interestingly enough, not for beans. It's a line to get out of Cuba. It's a line to U.S. to U.S. Embassy, which is disguised as U.S. Interest Section Bureau. It's called United States Interest Section Office in Havana. That's the biggest building in Havana, interestingly enough. It's the biggest building, all with all these antennas and radars and whatnot, a lot of Marine guards everywhere. So the presence of Yankee imperialism is still. The next one is a Spanish embassy, because Spain is taking Cubans as well. And the place is looked like an old besieged Spanish fortress, because they're just here the people are organized, probably Marine guards are doing that. But amongst, around Spanish embassy, it's just people are just trying to get in. And notice our workers. The good thing about socialism that and this are resorts. The interesting thing that Cuba has a dual economy. I told you about the have nots, about the suffering majority of Cubans, 95% of people in Cuba. But there is a 5% minority, maybe 4 even, because I talked to some economists also, Soviet-trained economists, and they were coming up with numbers completely different from what the CIA is feeding up us with. According to CIA, Cuban GDP per capita is $2,100. $2,100. And being once with a CIA officer doing seminars for the United States Army, just came from Baltimore here. Can you imagine Aberdeen Proving Grounds? That's the as you know, that's a national center for sexual harassment and of the United States Army, all the time investigated by. And so maybe they are so depressed by that, so they asked me to talk about decline of liberty from Moscow to Manhattan. So that was quite interesting for me too. But what I'm saying is that U.S. government is playing into these hands, into Castro's hands, through, again, the same thing like with the Soviet Union, with fake statistics. $2,100 in Cuba. It's practically like in Mexico. And Mexico looks like a superpower in comparison to Cuba. There are plenty of rich, arrogant Mexicans in Cuba who are enjoying themselves, who are buying this the major commodity there. I mean, people cannot sell anything except themselves, so prostitution is rampant. And so these Mexicans are coming, as they told me, on this sex safari trips to Cuba. And being on this sex safari trip. So in Cuba, it's definitely not 2,100. Because if you will multiply $10 on 12 months, so that doesn't look like 2,100. Even if you would throw in free health care, free education, and practically free rice and beans, because they provided a very low price. The issue of healthcare in Cuba is amazing. I mean, that's the best kept lie, I would say, the best kept lie, because you would, if you talk to your colleagues or other people in U.S. academia, they would say, okay, we understand that because Soviet Union betrayed Cuba by collapsing. because of that, Cubans are suffering. They are suffering, but they still have the best health care in the world. And they cite this fantastic numbers, like 5.4. That's the infant mortality rate. In the United States, 6.1. But in Cuba, it's 5.4. Isn't it wonderful? However, sure enough, Cuban people, they know better. They say that they register newborns only after half a year. When they're 6 months, then you can go and register a person. So those ones who would die before, they're just outside of statistics. Why to count them? I mean, to count these dead people. The people are reacting to these awful living conditions mostly by reducing their fertility. Cuba right now is practically, unlike other parts of South America, they have declining population. It's amazing what the government can do to people. They would even be depressed to the point that would not have families. There's some beautiful places, that's for haves. And the healthcare is, everywhere you go in Cuba, the people are told to tell foreigners that their health care is very good. So I asked my, I would say, Cuban Russians to visit. And so we visited a doctor's office, And doctor had aspirin, and he had iodine. That's just if you have something external, then he would apply this solution of spirit and iodine. You know, like this. It's kind of an ugly looking and terribly smelling solution to presumably which kills germs. Probably it kills anything. and so they would apply that if that's external, and aspirin if it's internal. And there also I was told that there is a black market for medicine, mostly for herbal medicine, which people are making themselves. A friend of mine who, when asked him in the presence of students, he said, well, yes, we have very good health care. He said, especially if we would keep in mind that we don't have medicines or ambulances. So that would be his way to tell the truth, right? Otherwise, he'd say, that's a fantastic system. Fantastic system. So statistics on mortality, infant mortality, fertility, I think it's just not available. I mean, that it's not that some people know. It's CIA is usually busy in recalculating statistics of rogue nations. They have something called Office of Foreign Economic Assessment, employing 7,200 people in Virginia. And they're trying to recalculate, thinking that, say, Cubans are coming up with 5.4, but we would know that this is a lie, so we would come with 7.3, because we think that they're just faking statistics. They're not faking, they're making statistics up. I mean, there's no primary reporting for most of statistics, because there's no primary reporting, then the final number is just was taken from the ceiling for propaganda purposes. And they can be very generous. I was even surprised, why 5.4, why not 3.1? Yeah. So that is the people. You can see people literally starving. Can see children who are trying to snatch, for example, bones from your plate when you're sitting outside. At first, when I came to Cuba first time 3 years ago, I didn't know about that. So I was and they have this remnants of capitalism. They have the sitting out kind of restaurants in Havana. So sitting out, whatever. And then I was talking to my companion, and then I saw a little black hand just snatching these bones, chicken bones from my plate. So you can see that people are not making it up. It's not that they are not taking it as a souvenir. They're just desperately, some of them are desperately hungry. The good thing, I think, one of the greatest achievements of communism and true achievements is complete absence of overweight or obese people. I think that New York Times bestseller authors would be very pleased if they would go there. Just I haven't seen obese people. With overweight people, it's a little bit, they have some, and as my friend Roberto, he said that we can actually identify who is the secret agent of Fidel's police. If you have some accumulations, that means that you are getting something from the government. So the same thing as in Cuba, I would say that the story would not be correct if I would say that. There was a freedom of movement in Cuba, relative freedom of movement. So until 1997, if you would have a family somewhere, then you could move to another city, In 1997, Fidel signed the law that this freedom of movement is the last freedom we need. And and that was, interestingly enough, that was against blacks. Why against blacks? Because Western Cuba is populated mostly by Afro-Cubans. And they were hit by this economic disaster completely. People were starving to death. So they were trying to get to Havana. The same in every communist country. Everybody wants to get closer to the kitchen. So that where the government is, because government will look on all the starving people around their big buildings and would say, well, we'll do something about that, give them, organize a soup kitchen or something. So these people were attracted by Havana. Also, this rationing norms, that the Havana would be the only place where they would be more or less enforced. I mean, everywhere else, like if you go in the provinces, then you can have this rationing card, but they wouldn't have rice. So that's why your rationing card is something like a socialist constitution. I mean, that provides you with all rights, but no rice. And that's why the people were trying to get to Havana. So they prohibited that movement completely. So everybody is staying where they are. They're not creating all kind of visual harassment for government officials when they drive around in their Soviet limos. So that's why I'm saying about Afro-Cubans, about blacks in Cuba, because the greatest supporters of Fidel Castro, he actually has a caucus in United States Congress. He has about 35 members of Congress who are openly supporting Fidel Castro and his great friend Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was ousted from Haiti recently. And I'm talking about black caucus, the black caucus in the United States Congress. And leaders of black caucus like Congressman Rangel, Congresswoman Waters, they are very frequent visitors to that island, to this island. Fidel Castro, he kind of reminded me a little bit of Yeltsin. He is funny. I mean, in his own murderous way, but he is funny. Because what he did, he opened something called Fidel Castro School of Medicine. And he invites people from all over Latin America to indoctrinate them. Because you cannot say it's a school of political propaganda. You should disguise it for something decent. So, medical, he offered 500 minority students in the U.S., free training in this school. He also offered members of our black caucus that he will send 2,000 doctors from Cuba to Mississippi, Alabama, and other places in desperate need for healthcare providers. So we hear that all and over again, and it's written on walls. He even suggested in year 2000, when the people in Florida were looking through all this. When we had this gridlock in Florida, he offered to send 500 Cuban observers to look what's going on there and qualify our elections as free or not. Interestingly, now that in Cuba they had any kind of elections which resemble like elections only about 60 years ago. Even before Fulgencio Batista. And Fulgencio Batista, who is also demonized by the left in the United States, so I was all the time suspicious that he probably was doing something right because he's such an evil person in the eyes of the... And sure enough, everything worth of looking at was built under him. I would say we should blame him very much for deserting Cuban people in the time of the crisis. He just took off and went somewhere else. He was definitely a tyrant. He was, overall, his death toll, as proudly would be told you by every Cuban boy, was about 5,000 people he killed. According to estimates of Cuban dissidents, Fidel murdered 270,000 people. And also squeezed out of the country 2.5 million Cubans. So Cubans right now are like Armenians all over. You would be surprised that there are more Cubans, not even in Havana, but say in Spain and in Europe. There are plenty of Cubans over there. Plenty of Cubans in Mexico and Venezuela. There are plenty of Cubans in Argentina. So Cuban diaspora is all over the world. 2.5 million of best people. Well, it's good for them, but it's bad for the future of Cuba. I mean, maybe after Fidel would die, then hopefully some of them would return with their expertise and money and would know how to fix the place. But that's I would say crimes of Fidel are just fantastic. And he is also known to be to like this kind of tortures and whatnot himself personally, like Stalin or Saddam Hussein. He would watch his enemies being tortured and killed. So that's from. I would say that he is probably a psychopath and compulsive killer himself. Right now he is 77 years old, and pessimists in Cuba are counting years, and optimists are counting minutes and hours. So we would would not know when he would because he is. His successor, Raul Castro, Minister of Defense, he is 74 years old. And I would think that he probably will be lost in transition because I think that in Cuba, transition towards normalcy, towards markets, would be probably very fast. Because people in that police state, they would come to you and would say, "He's a devil. He's a devil incarnate." And for me, that would be amazing because they risk everything for almost nothing. I mean, it just that means that they had enough of it to the point that they just speak out. I mean, what would be the benefits? I would say, yes, he is. And or in many cases, if you would come to Castro Lover, he would call a police officer and would say, "This person doesn't like." There are plenty of Americans who are engaged in this type of activities. Plenty of my Cuban-Russian friends told me the chilling stories about professors of sociology, English, history, coming to Cuba, talking to Cuban dissidents, and then reporting them to Cuban authorities. So that's the reality of today's Cuba. Well, I see that I have a little bit of time left, and I would like at first to kind of to wish Cuban people, because they still extremely, they couldn't kill their love of life, they couldn't kill their, I would say, entrepreneurship, which takes the strangest things, the strangest kind of ways. In Santa Clara, for example, we met a gentleman who said that he loves the United States, and he suffered for that. And we said, well, what are the circumstances? He spoke English. He tattooed the stars and stripes on his shoulder. And then there are at least kind of the signs of the cigarette butts that meant that he's saying that he was tortured by Cuban police when they discovered that, and they were just putting their butts, cigar butts on the flag of the United States. And so my students, definitely, they were literally crying, and he was completely washed with U.S. dollars, getting for just one expose like that more than other Cubans would get on their plantations for a couple of months. You never know, I mean, whether he did that himself or Cuban police did that, whatever, but people are trying to survive. The sad thing, however, is that my students would meet a lot of people of their own age. Some of them students from University of Havana, from Eastern University, from University of Trinidad, we visited these places, who would turn out to be prostitutes or thieves or beggars or whatnot. And it's very sad that what the government is doing to them, that they do not have any other way to sustain themselves. And Fidel Castro, sure enough, from time to time, he would pick up two or three prostitutes and they would shoot them publicly. So can you imagine that the government, there's a campaign against moral slaves. So the government, which have driven these people into the ground, would prevent them from feeding themselves. So it would be a very funny place if it wouldn't be so grim. Well, if you have any, I would be happy to take some questions or comments on.
In Venezuela, there's also a strong man that subverts private property rights and is destroying that country's economy. And and Venezuela happens to be awash in oil, deposits. How close is the cooperation between Hugo Chavez's government and Castro's, and does he help provide the oil that Soviets have that no longer are made up that shortfall that the Soviets no longer provide?
Definitely, yes. Fidel Castro is an idol not only in U.S. academia, but also among some crooks south of Cuba. And the people who would come to mind first would be Hugo Chavez and President Lula of Brazil. One of these tyrants in the making visited Cuba, were kissing. I was impressed by Colonel Chavez, however, audacity. He was kissing Fidel mouth to mouth. And Fidel right now looked like a very, very unfresh corpse. Yes, Hugo Chavez is supplying Fidel with oil. And yes, he is. I have some friends from Venezuela. They gave me some statistics from U.S. Federal Register, that amount of political asylum cases from Venezuela to the United States. In 1999, there was 27 cases. Right now, it's 19,000 cases. So very soon, we will have in Miami. Miami will not be Cuban anymore. It will be half Venezuelan, half Brazilian. So that's definitely it's a very sad thing. It's again the same thing, that the only lesson of history does not teach us anything, because for Chavez, the picture of Fidel, I mean, the success story there of one person is immense. I mean, he outlived, seven U.S. presidents. He has a lot of, according to Cubans, just a crowds of bastards. He had his own harems and whatnot. He lives in seven different buildings, different houses all around, from each one, each morning, the cavalcade of cars would go in all these directions. So if someone would like to kill him, then you would need to multiply your efforts by seven. So this is a very attractive for many power-lasting people. All right. Mm-hmm. Yes?
You mentioned the black market with respect to herbal medicines and healthcare. I'm curious how much you saw the black market providing for the basic needs of Cubans, above and beyond rice and bean rations that they may or mm-hmm. actually be getting.
Besides the black market, they also have open market, which was introduced by Fidel in 1994 when it was economic. So it's an open farmers market. Open farmer market, however, it's heavily taxed by the state. To sell on that market, you need to pay the state just to have a place, an extraordinary amount of money. And then people can go and buy things there. However, the prices in that market, if you are getting this 270 pesos a month, then the price on that market are prohibitive in most cases for you. So you cannot buy much. You can buy on this fresh market. It's mostly either foreigners or rich Cubans who would get relatives. Relatives in Miami, which were a huge liability. You wouldn't get a good job if the government would know that you have relatives in Miami, the gusanos, the bad guys. That right now, that's the way to survive, because these relatives would send you $100 a month. Can you imagine? $100 a month. So you're getting 10 times. You get an annual salary a month for doing nothing. And now there's plenty of people who have relatives. They don't work anymore. Because why should you work? I mean, if you're getting $100, if you work for $10, and also it's not in dollars, it's in pesos, and you definitely can buy all these beans and whatnot of a much superior quality on these farmers' markets. Besides that, there are a lot of... However, with dollars, you would be surprised what Fidel is doing. The markup, official markup, at least what the economists, Cuban economists told me, is 140%. That means that a boombox sold in these dollar stores for relatives and party officials, which in the U.S. would be $30, in Cuba would be $55. The same with almost everything.
Mm-hmm. A quick point. You mentioned race in Cuba. As it turns out, several of the most prominent political prisoners in Cuba are black. And ironically, while the Congressional Black Caucus and the NAACP have called for economic sanctions, for example, against South Carolina, they don't seem to have a lot of solidarity for their peers in Cuba who are being persecuted by a white autocrat.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. Without saying. And what's interesting, what Fidel is doing, the only person who is really profiting from this embargo is Fidel. Fidel and his because any time, interestingly enough, any time U.S. Congress would discuss lifting of embargo, then Fidel would do something spectacular, like jail these people. It was a year ago, in March 2003. He jailed 75 people to 1,500 years of jail and murdered another three without even trial. So that's exactly when the people in Washington would think about this insanity, would think, well, we'll leave it. And that doesn't make much sense because embargo is again, it's only against us. And all the grievances we have against Cuban government, we can definitely address through private courts or through arbitration of international law.
How do you explain this phenomenon of Castro idolizers and Che Guevara idolizers, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, this romantic vision of this?
Because these people definitely should be credited as the arch enemies of capitalism. These people hate capitalism with passion, and they were people like Che Guevara. He was a little bit of a different breed than Castro, who is kind of a sleazy and whatnot. But people like Che Guevara, he was a true revolutionary. He was, I think, genuinely misguided person, if not even mentally unstable. So he was risking his life, and he lost his life for the sake of revolution. And I was proud that none of my students, I had one student, she bought a T-shirt with Che Guevara, but none of my students, and they kind of harassed her into putting this T-shirt away. However, you can see a lot of students from the United States would wear this in any campus, almost on any campus. So that's because he was being idealized. The same with Lenin and whatnot. Looks like we thought when communism collapsed, we thought freedom, liberty is vindicated, communism collapsed. However, that means for some people, it means just let's have done more communism. More communism. Well, maybe I'm getting old and intolerant, but atmosphere on most U.S., I think, campuses is getting more and more. I feel asphyxiated. For me, just to come and breath some fresh air in Auburn is a wonderful thing to have. Because otherwise,
why?
Yeah. Well, I think some people try to address it. There's a nice. Essay by Hayek called Why Intellectuals Love Socialism. Then Murray Rothbard wrote a lot about that as well, because that gives them claim to power. They know more. They know better than gray masses of greedy capitalists. Greedy capitalists are making money, providing us with these wonderful things around, and what intellectuals do, they are kind of the dealers, second-hand dealers in ideas, and the ideas would be providing them with a claim to rule others.
I would recommend pick up the book, The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality, which is for sale right outside here. Mm-hmm. Answer to your question.
All right.
Last question. You said that you're glad to breathe air of Auburn. I come from a great multicultural socialist paradise in Canada. Mm-hmm. So I'm even more glad to be here, but also that meant that I could go to Cuba without getting special permission. But you mentioned that Fulgencio Batista must be doing something right, and I wanted to actually just speak up from a bit more, because you said he deserted the Cuban people. In fact, he had to leave Cuba because the U.S. withdrew support from him, which was the end of, similar to what Lou Rockford was saying earlier, which was the end of 60 years of well-intended but totally misguided influence on Cuban affairs. And I also think we should mention that Fidel was so popular partly because of the great efforts of that wonderful newspaper, the New York Times. A lot of talk recently about, I think it's about Walter Duranty, who supported Stalin.
That's right.
But people don't mention Herbert Matthews so much. Mm-hmm. He should be mentioned in the same sentence, because he was virtually Fidel Castro's PR man when he was in the Sierra Maestra. So anyway.
Absolutely, yeah. Herbert Matthews was Walter Duranty for Cuba. He was, I think, just assigned, probably they have editorial boards in New York Times saying, well, there's another communist coming up, so we would assign you to rescue that guy and to promote his views. Because now we have, I mean, all our mass media still is captured. I mean, still Barbara Walters loves him. Still Diana Sawyer, he kisses with him again. I mean, just, this is really a... this is really very, very courageous people. Then we have Dan Rather is the most servile. I mean, he talks like he's on the payroll of Castro. Then Oliver Stone with his idiotic film about Fidel, and he is telling us that he is the wisest person he ever met. He is the wisest person he ever met. Chris Christopherson, whom not? I mean, Yoko Ono is just unbelievable. All of these people, all the Cubans don't understand that. All my Cuban friends, all these people would be locked up for good in Cuba if they would live there for what they do, whatever. Yeah. So thank you.